You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Sitting down with James Lavish, the number one trending creator in Substack's finance section right now. How's it feel, sir?
I gotta admit, it feels fulfilling. It's satisfying. Yeah. I've put a lot of work into that newsletter.
Well, it's really good. I've been a paid subscriber for, I think, a couple of months now, not too long, but you wrote an article on the treasury basis trade. And when I hit the, you must pay to read the rest of this, I was like, you know what? I'm going to actually pay because I want to understand this
awesome.
Better.
Awesome. Awesome.
What do you think is driving people towards the informationist right now?
Well, you know, it's funny because this morning, Scott Bessent was, he was quoted as saying that we need to make people in America financially literate. We're not financially literate. We're not taught these things. You know, Marty, we're not taught them in grade school, not in high school, not in college. Even a lot of these concepts are not taught when you go get an MBA, even a finance MBA, not marketing, you know? There's a need for just education, general, big macro picture education, how all these things work, the Fed, the Treasury, bonds, bond yields, you know? And then of course, the new asset classes of Bitcoin, and you know, how it all kind of works together. But the real need is for it to be simple. And so I started the newsletter a little over, I guess it's almost 3 years ago because I'm on, well, it's got to be over 3 years now because I'm an issue over 162, 163. And so once a week you get there. So, but I started it because I noticed that there's just, everybody talks in acronyms and high concept, confusing topics. And I just constantly had people ask me, what does this mean? What does this mean? What does it mean? And so I just decided to start the newsletter that simplified it for them. And so the newsletter is supposed to be educational, really big concepts and the stuff that's really important about these, you know, it's not the simple stuff, but it's simplified, you know, so that was the point. And it's been very well received. People really like it. So.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but if I recall correctly, one of the things that led to the newsletter, you did a long thread on Twitter, it was Twitter at the time, on treasury auctions and how they worked. Was that the inspiration for the newsletter?
That was kind of one of them. You know, quite honestly, what really happened is I was toying around the idea of doing something crypto, something financial, and Sahil Bloom, of all people, put out this request. And he said, hey, if there's anybody out there who wants to team up and do a financial newsletter, there's a great need for a simplified financial newsletter. And so I reached out to him. He didn't respond. I only had like 10,000 followers at the time. So I wasn't a big enough account to, you know, to be a teammate of his, I guess. So, and about, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, I said, you know what, I'll do it. I can write. I've written many letters over the years for our fund, and I simplify stuff, and I'm pretty good at simplifying topics for people. I remember, you know, I like to make people smarter. You know, like it's really fun to explain to somebody when they say, well, how did you start on Wall Street? And I tell them about arbitrage, and they're like, what is that? And then at the end of the, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, they're like, God, I think I could actually, I understand it. I get it. And that's fun. I like that. So it empowers people because then they can turn around and use the, not arbitrage, but they can use these concepts in managing their own portfolio, their own wealth, and understanding what's happening around them. And that's really the most important part. And it's what you and I get to every single day, which is why is Bitcoin so important today? Why is it so important for everybody to understand this new asset class? And that really, I like to lead people along the path and have them make their own determination. Yeah, it's a no-brainer. Of course, this is what I need because of the evidence that's out there. So,
well, on that note, I think for me personally, I actually sent it a tweet out a few hours ago before hopping in the studio that it has never been clearer to me that the world needs a neutral reserve asset for the digital age than it is today. If you hold Bitcoin, tying in everything here, you are basically arbitraging the information asymmetry that exists because
I saw that tweet. Actually, I saw that. That's a great quote. Actually, I love that. So actually, I want you to actually read the tweet because it's a great tweet and it resonates because it's exactly what we're talking about. There's an asymmetry. There's an arbitrage of understanding, right?
Yeah, and again, I think that's something me personally, many people in Bitcoin that they understand this. But they don't understand that most of the world doesn't. And I think to what you're just saying too, I think why the information is so important right now. I got a paid subscriber, but a big fan following your threads, but you wrote about something that I really don't understand, which was this basis trade. And I paid to understand it. You write about it very clearly. And I understood it way better after reading it. But I think, as you mentioned, Scott Bessent out there, we need better information. I think people are looking at the world, looking at what Trump's doing with tariffs, looking at equities markets right now, looking at bond yields and saying something's wrong here. What is it? Where is the signal? And I personally think Bitcoin's the signal, but there is this information asymmetry that people don't realize. And I think what excites us is people who are in Bitcoin for many reasons, one of which is if that information arbitrage sort of that gap closes, that means that Bitcoin's going to go up significantly. And so I think it's trying to tie all those things together to basically highlight to people, there are some alarm bells over here. You should be worried about it. Here's why Bitcoin's a solution.
Yeah. I mean, today, Bitcoin the divergence from Bitcoin and risk on assets like the NASDAQ and regular stocks at the same time that bond yields are going down. The bond yields are going up, so bonds are going down. So you would think that the flight of safety would be to bonds. And for people who are new to this whole game, when you buy bonds, you're buying them at above or below par, right? And if you buy it below par, that means you're buying it at a discount, which means that the interest rate you're effectively paid, because you're getting paid coupons on these things, those coupons are set. So if you paid less for the bond, then that coupon becomes just a larger percentage. And so that's why yields go up when bonds go down. And that's kind of that's the way it works, right? So, but you would think stocks going down, well, then bond yields would probably be going down too because bonds would be going up because that money would be flowing into safety assets, like the risk-free asset, which is the US Treasury. Not really risk-free. We know that. We talk about that all the time. But that's the quote on Wall Street. Risk-free is a U.S. Treasury. It's not. It's not risk-free. We learned that the hard way during the pandemic when we way overprinted money, not we, the central bank, the Fed, way overprinted money, caused massive inflation from the expansion of the money supply, massive asset inflation, massive inflation across financial assets. And because we're so financialized as a nation, everything went up in price, along with supply issues and supply chain issues and bottlenecks and all that. But that was kind of a goat that should have gone through the boa and gotten out the other side. It never did. And we had these like this crazy inflation for years and years because of the expansion of the money supply. Let's just call it what it is. So you saw bond yields. What happened was bond yields spiked because Fed funds went up and bond yields went up in order to compensate investors for that high inflation. So if you're a bond trader, you're not going to buy a 10-year treasury at 2% if inflation's at 5%. You want to be compensated for that. And so when that interest rate goes up, the bond price goes down. And all these banks, all these community banks that were holding these treasuries got absolutely annihilated. And that's ultimately what caused the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank 2 years ago. And that's kind of, if people remember back, well, that's not risk-free to me. That sounds risky to me. It's risk-free in the sense that Yeah, if you hold it to maturity, it's a non-zero probability that the U.S. will hard default on that. But it's about as close to zero as you can think of, because the U.S. Treasury has the ability to team up with the Fed and print money to buy its own bonds. So, of course, they're not going to default. They're just going to just print money and make sure that these things are always trading. And so, you know, that's it's called the soft default. And that soft default is inflation through expansion of the money supply, which is debasing the U.S. currency every single day in order to keep this whole debt charade going. And that's kind of the point, right? So,
listen, freaks, I know you're tired of me talking about Fold, but I'm going to beat the drum. I'm going to beat the dead horse. If you're a Bitcoiner living in the United States and you're not using Fold, I'm just going to ask one question. What are you doing? You're leaving sats on the table. They've got gift cards. They've got their debit card. You can use your credit card. Just connect your credit card to the Fold app. Use the Fold app to pay off your credit card, and you're going to stack your credit card points and Bitcoin as well. They even teamed up with CrowdHealth to give their members Fold Plus membership at no cost. Don't leave sats on the table. Go sign up for Fold today. Go to tftc.io/fold. There's nothing to lose except sats that you could have stacked. Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got two secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a Cold Card Q. Go to coinkite.com, find the Cold Card Q. Use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the Cold Card Q. It's a beautiful thing.
And I think that's the question in my mind right now. I've jumped the gun quite a few times over the last 10 years trying to say something like this, but this, and it's one day of price action, but yields going up, stocks going down, Bitcoin going up, divergence. People have been throwing the decoupling meme out there, not quite confident enough to do it. But I think for the longest time, like you said, treasuries have been that flight to safety. Mm-hmm. You know that the Fed is going to monetize the debt if the government needs them to. It's happened historically. Many people, rightly or wrongly, assume that it'll continue to happen. But I think, is there something special about the environment we find ourselves in today, particularly with Trump posturing as he is towards Jerome Powell, that is beginning to stoke uncertainty in bond investors and the Fed's willingness, ability to do that moving forward? And that's why we're seeing this dislocation of markets that one day could be anomalous, but if it continues, is that what that's signaling?
Well, there could be cross signals here. There are a bunch of signals, right? So let's back it up and talk about, like, big picture, what's been happening. Well, Trump has threatened to enforce these tariffs on all these countries, and big tariffs. And so that has caused quite a bit of angst for a number of reasons. There's angst with people who import materials and goods to sell here in the United States. So you're getting some misinformation of the actual demand, the underlying demand of the economy, because you've got manufacturers and suppliers who are importing goods in order to get ahead of that tariff. The underlying economy has not been doing that great. There's a lot of negative indicators out there. And so we're just watching these things and seeing if they continue to kind of snowball, especially things like the unemployment rate, now that you've got government jobs coming out and all of that. But so you've got the economy is clearly softening. You've got cross current of information of what are the actual trade numbers? What are the actual, purchasing and index and the PPI and all that? Like, what's PMI, all, like, what are all these telling us? And then at the same time, you've got investors who are worried that the earnings of companies are going to get negatively impacted. At the same time, you've got bond investors worried that, well, if we're going to, you know, hammer China with these huge tariffs, they're going to turn around and they're going to shore up their own currency, and they're going to turn around. And the way they do that is by selling treasuries that they have. So if they sell U.S. treasuries, what does that make the treasury do? It goes down in price and yields go up. Something we may be seeing here, right? And so, or it could be traders getting ahead of that, worried about that scenario where China starts selling bonds, and not just China, other countries too, selling U.S. treasuries in order to get dollars to sell those dollars and buy their own currencies. Those are possibilities. You're seeing the dollar go down in value against other currencies across the board here. The DXY is down, and that suggests some of this is happening, or just the confidence in the U.S. dollar, the U.S. treasury is waning. That's all happening. And then you layer on top of it, Marty, that basis trade I was talking about. And that's kind of like the powder keg that is behind the scenes that the very, very intelligent investors know about. They understand it, and they're watching carefully. They're watching credit spreads. They're watching the spreads of the bonds to the futures, the bond futures. And they're gauging whether or not this trade has the is going down the path of blowing up in hedge funds faces. And there's a reason that this matters. And we have a history of this, right? So you are younger than me. You likely weren't paying much attention to this back in 1998. But I was a trader at a hedge fund, and we were doing all kinds of arbitrage strategies: convertible arbitrage, merger arbitrage, risk arbitrage, pairs trading between different companies. We had books and books and books, you know, billions of dollars to work in these arbitrage trades. And there's a hedge fund, large hedge fund called Long-Term Capital Management. People have heard me talk about this before. And in 1998, Long-Term Capital Management was doing very similar things that we were doing, plus other things, which included something along the lines of the basis trade that we talk about today, where they're arbitraging bonds that are similar, and they're just pulling out a few basis points from these trades. But in order to make it really profitable, they had to lever it up. And so they levered their book up like about, we estimate it was 100x or more, 100 times leverage or more. So they had $1 billion of capital, but they had over $100 billion of trades in swaps that we estimate. So now go back to 1998 when all this is going on. And these are geniuses that came up with the Black-Scholes model, by the way, the pricing model for derivatives, for options, you know, but they weren't very good portfolio managers. Took on way too much risk. And so the problem with this is it became binary. And what I mean by that is that once the Russian ruble was devalued and these bond spreads kind of blew out just kind of overnight, all these trades, they went against Long-Term Capital Management so quickly and so largely that the entire street heard about it and started unwinding all their similar trades that they had on that were similar to these, these arbitrage trades that they had on. Even stuff that had nothing to do with the basis trade, had nothing to do with currencies. It was just like merger arbitrage. So we had $1 billion of merger arbitrage positions, and they blew out. Like, these positions blew out huge. Like, when you have a spread in a merger arbitrage trade, it stays very tight from the time it's announced all the way to the close. It just gets, that spread gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it closes, and then it goes away. You deliver one security to another, you take that arbitrage and walk away. Because it doesn't matter what the market's doing. Only thing that matters is whether or not that merger closes. Well, all those trades were blowing out not because of anything that was going on with the companies and whether or not they were going to all merge or not. It had to do with liquidity. And everybody knew that long-term capital management was unwinding these massive trades. And they're like, oh, get out of the way. I'm going to let this thing go. Let them unwind their trades at a loss. And then we'll come in and scoop them up, which is exactly what we did. We came in and scooped them up. We made these huge spreads that we should never have been able to make. We had an extremely good year in the merger arbitrage book because long-term capital management blew up. But going back to the basis trade, what happened was these guys had those interest rate arbitrage trades on, and they started going against them and in a big way. And their counterparty risk in this whole trade was their main prime broker, which is your main broker for a hedge fund. Goldman Sachs was on the hook for a lot of this stuff. And so so it spread around the street that they were going to blow up, that Goldman Sachs is going to go under. And if Goldman Sachs goes under, they're going to take down the whole street with them, because the counterparty risk it's called contagion, where it goes from one bank to another bank to another bank. And all of a sudden you have all these banks that just fail. And so the New York Fed was in panic. They orchestrated a bailout for Goldman Sachs overnight. So that sets the stage for where we are today. It's been done before. The Fed helped orchestrate the trade. They didn't print any money. They didn't do anything, but they helped orchestrate it, right? They led that bailout basically by strong-arming other banks into helping Goldman. Well, now you fast forward to today, and you've got reportedly $1 trillion of these basis trades on, 10 times the size of the long-term capital management books. But the difference is it's spread across all these hedge funds. It's not just one hedge fund. And it's spread across all these banks. It's not just one bank. And a lot of these positions they're levered 20, 50, 100 times the one in order to make that 1 or 2 basis points into something that's actually attractive, right? Those few basis points, whatever it may be. And they're doing it with very little capital. And so here's the significant part about it, Marty, is that we're watching all this, and I don't know if these trades are being unwound, but I can tell you that there are hedge funds that are anticipating problems of other hedge funds with them. And so they're getting out of some of these trades, and that's why you're seeing some of the movement in the yields, I believe. And so, but what's happening is, and what's so important about this is that this is to get an idea of how impactful and how explosive this trade is. They had the Brookings Institution, for those of you who don't know what that is, it's a think tank out of DC. And it's basically a tacit research arm of the Fed. I mean, that's a very strong statement. But what I mean by that is that there are a lot of former Fed officials that work at Brookings Institution, and they research and float ideas and policy there to kind of see how they're received, you know, and what people think about it and what the Fed thinks about it. And so for instance, they did, and I've said this before, the Sahm rule, the Claudia Sahm worked at Brookings Institution. She was a lower Fed official. She worked at Brookings Institution. She came up with something called the Sahm rule, which is that unemployment rate rule that to keep the numbers very simple for everybody, basically, if the unemployment rate goes up by more than 0.5% from the bottom in a cycle, that means we're in a recession. We've gotten very close to that. But that's a rule that the Fed looks at now. That's something they use as a gauge to say, okay, we're in a recession. We've got to lower rates. You know, they haven't seen it yet. It's been very close, but, you know, that came out of the Brookings Institution. So now, go flash forward to today, you've got this basis trade. And the Brookings Institution put out a paper, a research paper. And they said that this trade is so big and so it is so dangerous that the Fed has to come up with some way to ensure that we have liquidity in our bond market if this thing blows up. Because what happens if $1 trillion of bonds come to the market from this basis trade? Well, it doesn't stop there. You know, it causes margin calls on everybody that is close to a margin call, which will cause margin calls on more people, so more investors. So if you remember back to the UK gilt crisis a couple of years ago, what happened there was something somewhat similar, where pension funds in the UK were, they were leveraging up their bond portfolio in order to get better returns because the yields on bonds were so low, because all these central banks were running very low interest rates for so long, for over a decade, that you were, you know, you couldn't, 2% was not getting you what you needed for your liabilities in the future for these pension funds, because they know what their obligations are, and they weren't keeping up with those obligations. So what did they do? They levered those trades up. What happened? Well, you had a finance minister come in and announce all these tax cuts in the UK without a way to pay for them. And the bond market said, oh my God, that means they're just going to print money. These bonds are worthless. We need, they're going to, you know, we need a higher interest rate to be compensated for that higher interest, that higher inflation rate. So I get a real rate of return. So we need to step back and let these bonds go to a price that actually makes sense. And what happened was the pension funds blew up because they had all these levered trades on, right? So then the Bank of England comes in, because the pension funds basically just, they called up the Bank of England and said, we're like all going to fail this afternoon unless you bail us out. And so what did they do? They swept in, they came in, they printed money, they bought bonds, they bought the UK gilt, and they saved the market. Well, why does all this matter? Well, it matters because what happened was one pension fund started selling, then another one had to sell, then another one had to sell, because it kept going to prices that was they were tripping these margin calls for everybody, even in these treasuries, you know, the UK gilts. This is crazy, right? Well, the same thing can happen here. And that's what the Brookings Institution and the Fed is concerned about. Oh my God, what happens if we start tripping margin calls on treasuries? The pristine asset of the world. This is literally the base asset of the world. It's the benchmark treasury, the benchmark bond of the entire world, the 10-year treasury. Well, what happens if that starts selling off rapidly, violently? Well, then you're going to start tripping these margin calls, and it's going to snowball. And then you get disorderly bond markets. Then you get disruption. Then you have a catastrophic sell-off, and they can't have that happen. We can't have that happen because we got $36.5 trillion of treasuries that are out there, that is on our debt, and we are running multi-trillion dollar deficits. Regardless of what Doge is doing, we're running deficits that we have to keep borrowing. The bond market must go on. The US Treasury market must be liquid. It must be stable. And if it becomes unstable because of something like this, then it's a big problem. So here's the punchline. The Brookings Institution came out with a solution. Well, we've got it. We've got the solution. What we're going to do is, instead of printing money this time, the Fed will just take the whole trade off of the hedge fund's books. They'll take the long side and the short side. That way the Fed is hedged. They don't have any risk. And we save the hedge funds. You know, hallelujah, the bond market's liquid. Everybody just go home. Thank you for playing. And we'll just keep going on our merry way. Absolutely, utterly fucking maniacal. Like, literally, it's insane. The thought of the Fed becoming a hedge fund. It's just, it's nuts. But that's a paper they put out for everybody to read, and they've floated this as an idea for policy. And if you have any question about how dangerous this trade is, that should tell you everything you want to know and need to know.
Yeah. So is that a roundabout way for them to introduce yield curve control without calling it?
That's a direct, like, well, we're just going to come in and just take this. So stabilize the yields exactly where they are. Exactly.
Our good friends, Parker Lewis and Dhruv Bansal, are two of the deepest thinkers in Bitcoin. While they come from very different backgrounds, they've landed on the exact same conclusion. It's Bitcoin that matters, not crypto. This masterclass lays out why 21 million is the key breakthrough, how Bitcoin, not blockchain, creates decentralization, and why everything else will be built on Bitcoin. Understand why Bitcoin works and why nothing else does. Watch the premiere at unchained.com/TFTC. That's unchained.com/TFTC. And so this... was happening, I think April 9th, it's April 21st today. So 12 days ago, it was Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. And people, it was right after, it was a week after Liberation Day. And everybody, like at market close, yields were going up. And people were like, oh, China's dumping. They're pissed at us for tariffs. But as the night got longer and we got later into the day and towards the 10th and the 30 year and the 10 year were screaming, people were like, it doesn't seem like this would be China dumping. This is not how they would sell. They were doing it. And Zero Hedge wrote their piece that night too, where they highlighted 2 years ago, the Citadel 0.72 Millennium, all these multi-strat hedge funds that were doing this basis trade.
Yeah.
At the time, 2 years ago, were 20X leverage. And you just play that forward to today. And you now people are saying 100X leverage. Now, I guess the question is like, is there any feasible way to unwind that trade outside of overt intervention from the Fed?
Not rapidly, not quickly. You know, I mean, it could be catastrophic to the market. Yeah. So you've got it. I would imagine some of these, some of them are unwinding some of it, but I'd also imagine, Marty, that you've got hedge funds who are stepping into it, you know, like they're looking for opportunity. If they see an opportunity, they think that they can stomach, they're going to step into it. So it might just be moving from book to book. We don't know. It's hard to tell. And so much of it is on swap. It's hard to tell.
Yeah. And considering the nature of how large this trade is and how entangled it was and the knock-on effects it could have on broader markets, it does make it like, because that's another sort of narrative that's been floated out there and it's like, seems to be confirmed by the administration is that our economy isn't let them eat flat screens. Scott Bessent and Trump saying what's good for the Mag 7 isn't necessarily good for MAGA Americans. Yeah. And like, is there a sense within the administration that they don't care about these hedge funds blowing up on this trade?
Yeah. But here's the thing though. We're so financialized, like I was saying, as a country, as an economy. If the stock market blows up, I mean, really blows up, we are headed for a deep recession. And the only way we can pull out of that is by printing more money. So what happens to bond yields? You know, bond yields will go up in that scenario because the bond traders, the vigilantes, are going to want to be compensated for the clear and obvious inflation that's going to come from another expansion of the money supply. And so that's the issue here. So do bond yields go down to 2% because we just slowly grind into a recession here? Or do they spike up to 5-6% because we have blown up the economy and the Fed's turning around and printing money to oblivion to save it? It's a good question. And that's why you're seeing a lot of uncertainty in the market. People don't know where we are on that spectrum. And some of it has to do with, you know, headlines and a tweet, you know, from Trump. I mean, he could just tweet something that just spooks the market to the point where, you know, you have the NASDAQ sell off 3-4%. Oh, well, look at that. It's down 2.5% today. You know, it was down over 3% earlier, I believe. But here's the telling thing. The telling thing is that bonds are not acting like they should as a flight to safety. That's number one. And number two, gold is absolutely ripping higher, rocketing higher, because it is a flight to safety. And investors are looking for a place to put money to just protect it. And gold has been a strong store of value for centuries. And now we get to the question about Bitcoin. And Bitcoin diverging today is very interesting. It's interesting because is it following gold? Is it finally, are people just realizing, like you said, that arbitrage, is that closing, that understanding arbitrage? Is it just because the dollar is so weak, which means that the dollar Bitcoin price goes up? That's part of it. You know, we were talking this morning on a different show, on the Macro Monday show, and Dave Weisberg brought up a great point that over the weekend, Charles Schwab talked about having a platform to trade crypto. And, you know, I've been talking about this for a number of months now that SAB 121, the repeal, the full repeal of that through issuing SAB 122, for those who do not know what I'm talking about, this is where the Fed a couple of years ago did an end zone run around legislation, and they put out this bulletin that basically said that banks had to hold Bitcoin as a had to hold Bitcoin and crypto as a liability on their balance sheet, even if it was just on the customers in the customer's account. So it basically prevented banks from dealing at all in crypto. And it was, this was kind of an aspect of choke point 2.0, where they just didn't want the banks to be involved. And, you know, you can kind of speculate who would be driving that. But up in DC, it's clear that Elizabeth Warren and her anti-crypto army were a very big part of all this, because when the Fed did that, and then a number of months later, almost a year later, I think, Congress met, and both Congress and the Senate passed legislation to repeal SAB 121, which is that bulletin. And then it got to Biden's desk, and he vetoed the repeal. And that was clearly he was pushed and advised by that psycho, the psychopath from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, who has absolutely, she has done nothing good for this country, clearly. Just a lot of talk and a lot of, you know, money going into her pockets. Insane. I don't know how Massachusetts keeps voting for that person, but in any case, he was advised by her team and other teams to repeal it, to veto that repeal. Finally, we get Trump come in. Trump comes into the office. Gensler resigns. A new bulletin comes out, SAB 122, that repeals SAB 121 and says that banks can own and hold crypto for and Bitcoin for customers without having to put it in as a liability on their balance sheet. And so now that's a very, 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 very big deal. It's a really big deal because you will have banks like Chase and Citigroup and Wells Fargo start dabbling into this space, especially in Bitcoin. And I expect other ones. I expect Ethereum and Solana and other ones. But they're going to start dabbling in these and allowing customers to buy and hold them right there at the bank, which is new. This is huge, you know, because you don't need a brokerage account. You can do it right there. You can do it right to your bank there. And they'll hold it for you. Like, this is going to be a big deal. And I think it's underappreciated just how important it is that banks will now get into this game. And this is part of the first they fight you, right? And then at the end they join you. And here they are. They're right on the cusp of that. And that's a big deal. So that could be part of this too. But I think that it's a combination of things, Marty. First of all, I think, you know, unless we get another meltdown of the market where everything correlates to one, and that's just reality. It, you know, the only thing that may not go down in that case is gold, but I think that even gold would, because when everything correlates to one, it means that you're getting margin calls everywhere, and you sell what you can, not what you want to, you know. And so everything ends up going down because you have to get cash to meet margin calls because everybody's levered. So in that case, Bitcoin will go down. But as it stands here today, it appears we've hit a local bottom in Bitcoin down at the, you know, $74,000 range. And we've recovered from that. And now we're bumping up against some serious resistance at the $88,000-$90,000 level. And we've got to kind of break through that mentally and hold that for this to stand. But I think that Bitcoin's catching a wave that similar to gold, where you've got investors who are putting money in both gold and Bitcoin, and that the US dollar being weaker is making Bitcoin stronger as well. And so it's a long way of saying that the decoupling, I appreciate it. I like it. I want to see it continue. And we're going to have to see, you know, weeks and months of this for it to really hold. But it's that information, understanding arbitrage you were talking about. And that's really what's going to drive this long term. And that's going to make people understand that Bitcoin is something that should be allocated separate to every other asset class out there.
Not only that, but to your point of first they fight you, or first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win or they join you. Like that, you wrote about it a couple of months ago too, or maybe last month, but like if now with SAB 122, with this administration and the regulatory overhang that existed under Biden, Gensler, Yellen is gone, like embracing Bitcoin as a collateral asset in the private sector and in the public sector, like everything you just described with the basis trade and the amount of debt that exists in the system and how everything's levered up. It's unnerving just to look at it and the gravity of it and think, oh my gosh, how do I fix this? You're going to have to print money. But at the same time, when you're doing that, it's like, all right, you begin to introduce the antidote to that. And I think like Bitcoin as collateral, whether it's via something like Bitbonds, so that the treasury can roll over debt at lower rates to solve that interest expense problem and hopefully take care of the debt at some point in the future, or the private sector where it's like your underlying collateral is either treasuries or assets that are suboptimal as collateral assets, and using SAB 122 as a way to begin introducing Bitcoin as better collateral into the system.
Right. And that's exactly right. So we'll come up with all these different products that are just not available now, you know, lending products, collateralized products, exactly what you're talking about, you know, put them in mortgages, put them, allow you to borrow against them to have lines of credit, you know, like it's going to be interesting. That's not going to happen today, but that's happening. It will happen.
Yeah. What do you think this does for Bitcoin? If we truly do decouple and you basically run with the fact that Bitcoin's more receptive, banks can use it, seems to be decoupling now, but also taking the fact like how much money is probably going to need to be printed to solve this.
Well, yeah. And so when you take that into account, Marty, what happens is the smart investors start reallocating money out of bonds and into Bitcoin. And then that's it. That's like Bitcoin will gain so many assets. Like it will be the total market value could double, you know, very rapidly. I still believe that's a little bit of ways off because of what you said in your tweet earlier, your post earlier, which is there's an understanding arbitrage, you know, there's an information arbitrage. People are not getting it yet, but when they do, and it does decouple completely, and it starts acting a lot more like gold does. And, but it's gold on rocket fuel because it's in its adoption phase. And of course it's going to have its volatility because any asset in adoption phase is going to have a volatility, but volatility to the upside. Of course, you and I have talked about this both before it's a gift. A volatility is actually attractive in a rising asset because it gives you the opportunity to dollar cost average in or find spots that if you're a savvy investor to find spots to add extra capital during those super volatile periods. So, I believe that's the key though. When you start seeing investors reallocate out of bond portfolios or out of their bond allocation into Bitcoin, man, that's it. That's going to be that to me is where that's really the pool that once Bitcoin starts drawing from, it's a $330 trillion pool. Once Bitcoin starts drawing from that, lights out, game over, watch out. I would not be short this thing.
Do you think strategy and how they've been tapping the convertible debt markets is a canary in the coal mine for that larger trend?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit different for them because what are they doing? So what MicroStrategy, now known as Strategy, what they've been doing, and I've had long talks with their treasurer, Shirish, about this. They've found a way to capitalize on the underlying volatility of their stock that's tied to Bitcoin. Well, how did they do that? Well, volatility is attractive on Wall Street in some instances. And this is one of those instances where the volatility of the underlying stock allows strategy to issue bonds that are convertible into common stock, called convertible bonds, that the investors, hedge funds, love because this is a rising asset and MicroStrategy's Bitcoin is a rising asset. MicroStrategy's stock is directly correlated and tied to Bitcoin because it owns so much Bitcoin on its balance sheet. And so the volatility to the upside is attractive to convertible bond traders, the hedge funds, because they can buy these and have that optionality of converting these bonds into common equity later at a price that is highly profitable. And it goes through the strike price and they get a whole bunch of extra money out of it, basically. So that's one part that's attractive. The second part that's attractive is just the volatility intraday, day to day, week to week, because they can trade around these things. What do I mean by that? Well, they own the bond. It's convertible into a certain amount of stock. I know you know this. You're a savvy investor for 1031. But for the listeners out there, it's convertible into stock. And so what these convertible bond owners, the traders, the hedge funds will do is they'll do something that's called a delta hedge. The delta hedge is the delta is the optimal amount of stock to be short against the bond. So you're short the stock, you're hedged-ish. So when the stock goes up, you can short more. And when it comes in, you can cover. And you can trade around that all the way through to expiration and make money on this volatility. And so the volatility is attractive. It becomes an asset to MicroStrategy, to Strategy. And so because of that, they're able to issue these bonds with zero coupon. So the bond traders are now like, well, we don't care about the interest rate. We don't care about, you know, getting 5, 6, 7% interest on this. We want the big stuff. We want the big moves. We want to be able to delta hedge this thing. So give us a better strike price. Give us an attractive strike price instead of, you know, attractive yield. We'd rather have that. And so that's basically what they've been able to monetize that. They've been able to monetize the underlying value of that volatility that's attached to their stock. And here's the best part about it is they do it every single time they do it, it becomes more closely tied to Bitcoin and that volatility creates more opportunity to do more. And so, of course, they continue to do it. And so that's what they're doing. So that's a little bit different. And I would say that rather canary in the coal mine, more just the largest signpost out there that this is an asset you should have on your balance sheets because this is something that is going to be extremely valuable for any company to have on their balance sheet in the future. As long as you think it's not going to collapse and go to zero, which the funny thing about Bitcoin is that the more it goes up in price, the more stable it is, the bigger the network grows, the higher the hash rate. I mean, the hash rate is, that's the canary in the coal mine. That's what is going on with the hash rate is it is absolutely screaming to all time highs. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this because I have thoughts, but it's almost mental where this has gone.
It really is. Especially considering, we had two very good years from a return perspective in 2023 and 2024. But hash price, like the value in sats or dollar terms per hash that you produce as a miner is still at basement levels. I think it's at like 4.5 cents a terahash per day right now, which is not a lot. Historically, it's been anywhere. I mean, I think the mean of last cycle was around 10, 11 cents. And at the time, it felt very low for people. So we're 60% below that. And despite that, hash rate screaming. I think it's a combination of things. Number one, the machine's getting extremely efficient. The amount of terahash you can produce per joule of energy provided to the machine is going up, significantly becoming more efficient. So the machines, you can do more with less energy. So that's definitely affecting hash rate, I would imagine. But I have to think that there are nation states. I mean, when you play into the game theory of Bitcoin, you want to acquire it without signaling to the market. And I think it's very hard to keep rumors of OTC desk out of the broader market. So if you wanted to acquire Bitcoin without going through that mechanism of calling a desk and saying, hey, I'm from Y government and I need X amount of Bitcoin. And then that broker goes and says, hey, guess who I just sold to?
Yeah.
You buy ASICs in an obscure way, you plug them in and you mine that way. And if you're a nation state,
you plug them in nowhere Siberia that nobody can see what's going on.
Yeah.
And you start mining Bitcoin. That's right. And you do it with very efficient machines at a very high hash rate. And you don't care. You don't care what it's costing you because you're printing your money anyways.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So
that's what I think is driving. And we already have examples of this. I mean, nobody would know that Bitan has been mining Bitcoin since 2020 if they didn't get caught up in the bankruptcy proceedings of Celsius and BlockFi. Like, I would not be surprised if those companies didn't go bankrupt, or if the Druck Holdings, the Bitan Sovereign Wealth Fund, didn't have assets on those exchanges, that they would still be under the radar today. But now they've sort of been forced into the public. And
yeah,
I mean, that's an example. If those bankruptcy proceedings didn't happen, like, nobody would have known that the small nation, the Kingdom of Bhutan, has been acquiring Bitcoin since 2020. You have to imagine.
How many of those are out there? Exactly.
Yeah.
A lot more. So it's very interesting. And that's it, the game theory. And that goes back to, well, yeah, the United States is signaling a very strong signal that they're going to be buying Bitcoin here at some point. And it's, you know, we've got people in the administration who understand it. I don't know how well Trump understands it. That's kind of beside the point. But Senator Lummis understands it. Bessent understands it. Lutnick understands it. Like, these guys get it. They understand what this is and how important it can be. And so what you were talking about before, the Bitcoin bonds, yeah, that could be a very important way for us to monetize this new asset for the United States and stabilize a treasury market that could get unruly here if we continue down this path of money printing to save the treasury market over and over and over again. And so treasury traders, investors are going to demand, they're going to need a higher return. Pension funds can't meet their obligations unless they have a return that's matching inflation or better. So that becomes a big challenge for them. So the point is that other nations they're not asleep at the switch here. They're watching this. There's a lot of confusion, a lot of noise about the tariffs and all that stuff, but they're listening to what the United States is doing. They're watching this. They're saying, man, if they corner this Bitcoin market, and it really does continue to be nation state level resistant because of the amount of energy it would take to, create a fork or whatever, then they have no choice. That's the game theory right there. But to just start doing anything they can to accumulate themselves now. And I believe that it has begun. I don't know how how widespread that is. We could just have a couple very large nation states doing it, and that's why hash rate is screaming higher. But it's not the public miners that are doing it. They're not out there pushing hash rate up like this. It just doesn't make sense. So mathematically and financially,
I think the share of unknown blocks mined, like the quote unquote unknown pool, which is like pools that aren't publicly marketing themselves, I think it hit 13% at one point last year. which wouldn't surprise me. I could be wrong on that exact number, but somewhere in a material amount of hash rate. It was defined as unknown.
There you go.
On the network right now. And when it comes to like Bitcoin in the United States, too, that has been a bit shocking to me, is like this outward signaling, considering the game theory we just walked through. If you're going to acquire Bitcoin, the last thing you want to do is tell people. You want to get it first and then tell people that you got it, which is like...
That's like trading 101.
Yeah.
You don't say, okay, we've enacted the Bitcoin strategic reserve. We're going to go buy 1 million Bitcoin. Like, the Bitcoin would double like that. Makes no sense.
And you have to think there's people within the administration that get this. And so that makes me wonder, like, do they actually have more Bitcoin than people think? Like, they're
right.
David Sachs.
Yeah. Are they accumulating it in a way? Yeah. David Sachs is another one that understands it.
Yeah.
He follows all of us, right? So,
yeah.
So that's interesting.
And I do truly think, like, Bitcoin is, if it's Bitcoin, combination of Bitcoin and gold, like, I think the Treasury, the Fed, and we'll just focus on the Treasury, is at a point where they need to think creatively, boldly, to reorient the American economy and particularly debt markets. And
yeah,
I think Bitcoin's one of the only ways to do that. And it seems like Bessent understood this well before he was even tapped for Treasury Secretary. I mean, I'm sure you've seen at the Manhattan Institute fireside conversation where he's like, there's going to be a grand economic reordering and I want to make sure I'm on the ship while it's happening, because my whole career is building up to this. And so to your point about tariffs and everything, I think that's noise. I think there is some grander reordering or reorienting going on in the back end.
I can't wait to see how it works out.
Neither can I. I think Bitcoin's going to benefit massively. Despite it, like, that's the beauty of Bitcoin. Whether or not they're successful, I think in both scenarios, if the government's very successful in this geopolitical global monetary system reordering successful, or if it fails, I think we would hope for a success model, because failure could lead to some chaotic situations. But in either of those situations, Bitcoin succeeds, because if you're going to have this reordering, it's like, all right, we need to do it around this reserve asset. And if that fails, it's like nobody can trust anybody. And so everybody naturally is going to be like, all right, let's get to the protocol that nobody has to trust.
Right. Yep. That's the beauty of Bitcoin, either way.
Yeah. Well, James, where can anybody listen to this find out more about The Informationist and what you guys are up to at the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund?
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of what you just said, is why we're so optimistic. And I know you guys are at 1031 also. We're super optimistic about the environment. And even if we have drawdowns, it's just opportunity for us to find value in the market. So we're a little bit different for the listeners. The Bitcoin Opportunity Fund is a little bit different than what you guys are doing. We are a hedge fund. We do invest in both public and private companies, but we focus on more mature companies. The core of our portfolio is on more mature companies. A lot of them are public companies, or private companies that are further down the road that are revenue generating rather than true, venture capital. We do have some that we think are very attractive, but our portfolio is definitely different than what you guys are doing. And we just launched Fund 2, and we are now open for investments. As you guys, I think you guys are raising too, but different again. I think they're the kinds of things that you ought to have in your portfolio. You have to have your Bitcoin, and you've got different ways to invest in the network, the protocol, how this growth engine. But it's for accredited investors like yours is. But if you're interested, you can go to bitcoinopportunity.fund and just fill in some information. We can talk to you, and we'd be happy to. And then The Informationist is on Substack. There's a link to it right in my bio on Twitter, on X, which is just James Lavish. That's me on X. There's a lot of clones like we all have out there. So make sure it's the one with the blue check mark. But I appreciate being on here. It's good to talk to you finally for a longer period of time than just passing at a conference. And so, and I appreciate the kind words.
It was a long time coming. I can't believe it took this long, but I'm happy. And hopefully this is the first of many James, you're crushing it. Thank you for coming and educating us about all of this. And like I said, hopefully we can do this again at some point in the future.
Absolutely, Marty. It's great to be here, and I look forward to the next time.
All right. Peace and love, freaks. Okay. Freaks, thank you for listening to the show. I hope you liked it. If you did like it, please make sure you subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps us out a lot. And also, if you like these conversations, I've come to realize that many people listen to the podcast. They don't know we have another sort of layer of this media company. We have the newsletter, the Bitcoin Brief. Go to tftc.io. Make sure you subscribe there. A lot of the topics that are discussed on this podcast, I write about 5 days a week in the newsletter. We also have the TFTC Elite tier. If you sign up for that, become a member. We have a private Discord server for the elite freaks out there where we're dropping ad-free versions of this show and having discussions about everything we talk about a day early. Logan wanted me to make sure if you want to get the show a day early, become a TFTC Elite member, you will get that. We have our Discord server. Right now it's conversation between myself and TFTC Elite tier members, but we're going to expand that. We'll probably do closed Q&As with people in the industry. I may be doing Macro Mondays. So join us. Go to tftc.io. Subscribe. Find the button in the top right corner of the website. Become a TFTC Elite member. Thank you for joining us. Okay.